Navarro.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you and welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute. We're here for a public lecture sponsored by Sun Life Financial. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach at Perimeter, and it is my sincere pleasure to welcome all of you here today. I also have two special welcomes. I'd like to welcome Neil Hayes, representing Sun Life, and I'd like to welcome our online audience as we are webcast around the globe. We have a social media room set up. Dr. Damian Pope and a team of master's level students from our SCI program are behind their keyboards, ready to join in the online discussion and answer any questions during the lecture. And also, if you want to participate in that conversation, use hashtag brainstem. Now, when you arrived today, you walked through the main floor and you saw that it has been transformed. The festival, Brainstem, Your Future Is Now Festival, is part of a much larger initiative. The festival itself is designed to connect deep scientific discovery with the amazing technological innovations that they lead to, and then encourage all of you to imagine your future with the scientific and technological world in which we live. But it's part of even a bigger, broader initiative that started with special funding from our federal government over 2 years ago. The entire initiative started with an unconference. We brought together the very best content creators from YouTube. We brought world-class teachers from around the globe, and we brought together entrepreneurs, and we put them together in a room for a thought incubator. And in 2 days, what they came up with kickstarted our second big component of this whole initiative, a grade 10 in-class careers resource specifically designed to connect 21st century skills, creative thinking, creativity, critical thinking, entrepreneurial thinking, collaboration, and connect those skills to the STEM disciplines of science, technology, engineering, and math. This resource will be shared across the province, and it will be done in part by our own Perimeter Teacher Network. They were here this summer getting familiar with the resource and have already started sharing it. And then there's a special collaboration that I really wanted to highlight today. We have a collaboration with TVO Kids. It's an I Wonder Why video contest. If you are between the ages of 4 and 11 and you have a science question, you submit that question via video, and if you're lucky, a Perimeter scientist will answer that question, and then both the answer and your question will be shown on TVO Kids. Now, there's also other cool prizes. There's telescopes and science kits. So go to tvo.org and you can submit your video there. All right, and then finally, all of this work now, Brainstem, Your Future Is Now Festival, it's our public celebration of this event. We couldn't have done the festival without the incredible support from our partners, from our presenting media partner, TVO, from Eclipse Production, who have created this unbelievable set and that experience outside, and Tidal Entertainment, who have stitched it all together. I would like you to join me in thanking our partners. Without them, we couldn't do this. And now, it's my sincere pleasure to introduce today's very special guest speaker, Lucy Hawking. Lucy, oh, don't clap yet, I got lots to say. Lucy writes extraordinarily interesting and inspirational adventure stories for children on cosmology and astronomy. She has written 4 books with her father in the George series. But before writing books, she first studied modern languages in the UK at Oxford University and then moved to professional journalism. She has written for magazines and newspapers across the UK and across the United States. And in 2008, she received the very prestigious European Sapio Prize, which is for science communication and popularizing science. And then, just this last summer, Lucy broadcast her very first documentary on BBC Radio. And it looked at how the synthetic speech technology has evolved over time. And here today to take us on an extraordinary journey, she's going to look at how imagination plays a role in scientific discovery and scientific innovation. Please welcome Lucy Hawking.
Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to The Future Is Now at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo. My name is Lucy Hawking, and today we're going to be talking about imagination. But we're not just going to talk about imagination. We're going to make our imaginations work for us as we go on a great cosmic journey across the universe. And here is a little bit of it. We're going to think about what would it be like for us if we could fly in space? What would it be like if we could travel to far distant galaxies? What would it be like if we could land a spaceship on an empty planet and step off knowing you were the first person to walk on that planet? What would it be like to meet an alien? And what would you say? So, we've got a long way to travel today. We're also going to talk to some scientists and find out how they use imagination in their work and how this has helped them to unlock the universe for us and has also had a profound impact on life on Earth. But before we get moving, I'd like to know a little bit more about my audience. I'd like to find out where you guys are from. So, could I have a show of hands? Is anybody here from Waterloo? Oh, welcome. Is anybody here from another city in Canada? Is anybody here from another country? Is anybody here from another planet? Welcome. Welcome. What took you so long? I am from Cambridge. And here's a lovely picture of my hometown. And as you can see on the river, we've got these people going up and down the river on these flat boats called punts. And punts, before people invented the car and the truck, this is how supplies traveled up and down the river. And now it's a tourist attraction, and you can rent a punt, and if you're really good at it, you might look like this. And I know it's just a photo, but I still think you can tell I'm going really fast. Cambridge, like Waterloo, has a university. But Cambridge University is a little bit older than the Perimeter Institute. And quite recently, it had a really big birthday. And I just wondered if anybody here, not you, James, there's somebody from Cambridge in the front row, anybody here apart from James knows how old is Cambridge University? Does anyone want to guess? I'll take a guess. Yes, what do you think? Give me a number. Yeah. How long? 400. I heard somebody else shout out another number. What did I have from 800? Exactly. You're very nearly there. Cambridge is 804 years old. And so during that time, the university has been home to some very, very great scientists. And here is, some would say, the greatest of all, Sir Isaac Newton. And when he saw the apple fall, he realized that it was the same force that kept the moon in orbit around the Earth and the Earth around the sun. So with that, he discovered gravity. And then we have Charles Darwin, who sailed across the world to collect a mass of information, which allowed him to develop his theories on evolution and natural selection. And in the 20th century, we have these two gentlemen, Watson and Crick, who, when they weren't drinking beer in their favorite pub, used their own observations and those of their colleagues to figure out the structure of the molecule of life itself, DNA. So these are three great discoveries that came out of Cambridge: gravity, evolution, DNA. And they're so familiar to us now. We feel like we know them so intuitively that we can't imagine living in a world where, for example, we didn't know about gravity. But somebody had to discover it. It took a scientist using information and imagination and intuition to make a leap of discovery. So I then asked some scientists working in the present. I asked them, how does imagination figure in their work? What does imagination mean to them as a scientist? And here's what they said. Fabiola Giannotti, she's one of the architects of the Large Hadron Collider, so the great experiment in Europe trying to recreate the early universe. And she says, imagination is the fuel of science. And she goes on to say, without imagination, we would not have the light bulb, as the latter is not the evolution of the candle, which is just a brilliant point. Paul Davies, British theoretical scientist, says, theoretical physics is an exercise in exploring imaginary worlds. Lawrence Krauss, very distinguished Canadian theoretical physicist, cosmologist, he says, trying to imagine hidden realities that are consistent with a world we already know is a very challenging task. And Brian Green, New York physicist, great renown, he says, the most astonishing examples of scientific insight start from two very different ideas and imagine a deeply hidden connection between them. And the example he gives is Newton looked at falling apples and the orbiting moon and imagined that the same force was at work in both cases. So I think this really gives us an idea of the profound connection of imagination and science. And so that's scientists of the past, scientists of the present. But the theme of this festival is the future. And my view is that when we start talking about the future, we really need to be addressing the people who will be in charge of it. And that means anybody who's at elementary or high school now, we're talking about your world, because we're talking about the world that you, where you will be the adult, where you will be in charge. So what we've done is we've created a questionnaire, and it's going to be online with the Perimeter Institute. You can go online and fill it in. There are no right or wrong answers. It's just an attempt to try and find out what you think. And for now, instead of taking you through the question point by point, we've animated it. And you may well recognize the voice of the narrator. So here it is.
Imagine if we could build a city on the moon, where people live and work, and kids go to school, where supplies arrive by space elevator, and spaceships arrive and leave every week. This is possible. Imagine if all the plastic in the seas could be recycled to make clean energy. We could light our homes, fuel our cars, and give the fish a clean ocean to live in. This is possible. Imagine if you could have a robot for a friend. Your robot could take you to school. It could cut your hair, it could brush your teeth, and read you a story. This is possible. So many things are possible, but you have to imagine them first. Can you imagine a future that no one else has thought of?
So that is our questionnaire. And if you get a chance to go online and fill it out, we'd love it, because it's your chance to tell us what you think. We've got a colony on the moon. What would that be like? What would be the problems of creating a habitat for human beings on the moon? How would we do that? What would be the major challenges we face? And what would be the point? What would be the advantages? We've got plastic, garbage in the oceans. Now, when we sent out this questionnaire, we didn't realize that the new XPRIZE, which is a very large prize for innovation, was going to choose the same topic as us. So there are 6.14 billion tons of garbage going into the oceans every year. And so the XPRIZE is asking for solutions. What are we going to do? Which, funnily enough, is exactly what we're asking in our survey. So you can respond to us, or you can try and win £50 million. It's your choice. And then we've got robots, our robot friend. Just have a show of hands, just out of interest. Who here would want a friend who was a robot? Anybody? Yeah. I think I would have a robot friend. And what we ask you to do in the questionnaire, we ask you to think about what would you want your robot friend to do and what would you not want your robot friend to do. And because we've already had some responses, I can tell you what we don't want the robot to do. We don't want the robot to walk the dog, open birthday presents, wake me up, follow me, which is a good one, choose my clothes. And no real support for robots performing medical operations, flying helicopters, or looking after babies. But we are quite keen on robots doing our chores. That was the overriding, yeah, including homework, washing up, making tea, cooking, and polishing my shoes. So, our robot here, as you can see, he says on his chest, it says, once upon a time. Which is, of course, how all stories start. Once upon a time, there was a boy called George, and he lived with his mum and dad in an ordinary suburban house in England, and in the garden, he had a pig. And one day, he goes down to the end of the garden to find his pig has gone. His pig has vanished. And so he follows the prints, the pig prints, into next door's overgrown jungle of a garden, where he meets a little girl called Annie and her father, Eric. And in George's Secret Key, which is the first of the adventure stories that I've written with a number of amazing scientists who have very kindly contributed their time, their energy, and their words to these books, we meet Eric, who in George's Secret Key, Eric is the world's greatest living scientist. And he has the most powerful computer in the world, which looks just like my little laptop, except there's a pretty big difference. This computer, Cosmos, can draw a window onto the universe, and he can show you extraordinary things happening in space. And the first time that Eric uses Cosmos to show George something in space, he shows him how a star is born. They see how a great cloud of gas and dust compacts over time and through gravity to become a ball, which gets so hot at its heart, it starts to burn, turning it into a star. And then George sees how it reaches the end of its life. Of course, this is massively speeded up. This would actually take millions of years. George sees how it explodes. Great big supernova explosion, sending a hot, gassy cloud across space. And he finds out that in this cloud are all the things that the star made while it was burning. And these things are the elements. So that means calcium in your teeth, the oxygen we breathe. Anybody here wearing anything made out of gold? Anybody got gold on them? Yeah. You're wearing something that was forged in the flash of a dying star. So, George also finds out that this computer can draw doorways and that you can walk through these doorways to any part of the known universe that you want to visit. And mums and dads in the audience, I'm sure you'll appreciate that if you had a computer like this in your house, you'd have some pretty strict rules about who can use it, how and when. And pretty much rule number one would be kids may not get the computer, open up the doorway to space and jump through it when their parents are not at home. Which is, of course, exactly what George and his friend Annie do. They open up the portal, they jump through the doorway, they land on a comet. So here they are, surfing the solar system on a comet. Potato-shaped ball of ice and rock, traveling through the solar system. And they're so close to the magnificent ringed planet of Saturn that George actually reaches out and takes a rock from the rings of Saturn, takes it home with him. But they also face conflict because we have evil, evil scientist, Dr. Reaper, who wants to use his scientific knowledge and his genius for his own selfish purposes, which puts him in contrast with Eric, who wants to use science to benefit humanity. And we're going to have the battle between these two and how Dr. Reaper tries to harness the energy of a black hole to dispose of his rival, Eric, by sending him too close to the event horizon of a black hole, which, of course, as I'm sure we all know, would do this, turn him into spaghetti. Will Eric ever, ever return? Well, that is the crux of that book, so I'm going to leave you to read the book and find out. And then we have George's Cosmic Treasure Hunt. And this is a book about how do we know what we know? How do we travel across the universe? What do we have at our disposal that allows us to find out knowledge? And we start with space travel. We start with mankind's physical ability to travel into space. And if we were to do that, then really the first thing we'd need would be a spaceship. And here's one that no one's using. It's been retired, so I don't think anyone will have a problem if we just jump in, buckle ourselves up. If you take the left-hand seat, that makes you the commander of the spaceship. So sit yourself down in the left-hand seat and prepare for liftoff.
T-minus 15 seconds. The second umbilical tower moves away from the Soyuz.
Preliminary. Preliminary.
T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Intermediate. Prime and liftoff.
First stage engines. Should be at flight speed now. Liftoff. Liftoff of the Soyuz rocket transporting Mike Fink, Yuri Lonchakov, and Richard Garriott to their home in space.
So there we are. We have left the Earth behind us with a great blast of power to get us away from the Earth's gravitational grasp. And pretty much the first thing we're going to find is this. Human beings have a habit of making a mess of any new habitat that they take over. And I'm afraid low Earth orbit is no exception. There are now over a million pieces of space junk flying around in orbit around the Earth. And that's anything from a chunk of spacecraft to a fleck of paint. And some people even say that there's a toothbrush out there in orbit around the Earth. And if that's true, it's moving at the same speed as everything else. That's 17,500 miles an hour. So you have to get your spacecraft past the speeding space toothbrush to here, where we can dock, climb through the hatch into the International Space Station, our permanent manned home in space. And if we were able to do that, then this is what we would find. And of course, what would be the first thing we would notice? Which is not that these gentlemen are all going bald. That's not the right answer. Would anybody like to give me a different answer to that? Yes, what would you notice about them? What would you notice that's going on there? They're all floating, well done. That's right, they're floating because they're in a micro, very well done. They're in a microgravity environment. So everything around them is floating, which means that some things are quite hard to do. So imagine if you went into your school cafeteria, your work cafeteria, or home, to get your lunch, and you had to catch it. Or sleeping. So imagine if you went to lie down on your bed, and instead of lying on your bed, you're actually floating on top of it, and then your duvet is floating on top of you, and then you fall asleep, but instead of staying in one place, you float off around your house, bumping into people. That would be very awkward, and that was happening quite a lot. The space station was getting very difficult to get any work done because of floating, sleeping astronauts. So now they zip themselves into a sleeping bag and they tie themselves to the wall, sort of a bit like bats, really. Something else that's very difficult to do in zero gravity is use the toilet. But because it's recognized as a difficult thing to do, there's a specially designed space toilet. And NASA astronauts, you'll be riveted to know, have special toilet lessons. So should you ever get through the relevant exams to become an astronaut, and there are a lot of them, you will find yourselves having special toilet sessions. Now, of course, it's not all just catching floating food and sleeping. Astronauts have work to do. They have spacecraft to build or mend. They have specific missions that they go out into space to achieve. And while they're out there, they also have a chance to see the Earth from an amazing vantage point. And they also do experiments. And the spacecraft launch we saw earlier, that was a friend of mine called Richard Garriott, who's an astronaut. And when he went up to the International Space Station, he did some experiments that were suggested to him by school students. And he made some videos of himself with the doing the experiment. So I thought we might just take a look at one or two of them.
Daniel Hayes and James Newsome from Ilkley Primary School want me to create a zero-gravity magic carpet and try to surf on a towel. Well, here's a towel, and you'll notice that the towel actually would make a mighty fine magic carpet, because up here in space, everything floats. And so I can easily take this towel and get on top of it and fly around as if it was my own personal magic carpet. If you were here, you could have one too. Here in space, towels make perfectly good magic carpets.
I did say we would be covering all the really important questions today, so here's another.
There were six of you that asked about gargling in space, brushing your teeth and spitting in a sink, and a lot of those other very practical daily functions. Well, here in space, they have to be done a little bit differently. For example, there's no sink. There's no traditional plumbing like you would see in a normal house. Instead, for example, here is a drink bag that I've created, filled up with some water for an earlier experiment. I've unfolded a little straw here at the end from which I can drink, and I will attempt to gargle. But I can tell you as a fact, it does not work. And as soon as you start, the water just starts coming out of your mouth because there's no gravity to hold it back in. So around here, once something gets moving in a certain direction, water droplets, for example, off they go, and you'll have a hard time getting them back. That's why I brought my towel.
So there we are. That is life on the International Space Station. I think we've got it pretty well covered now, and a pretty good idea of what it would be like to be an astronaut on the ISS. But we must move on. We have really not gone very far. If we were to travel from the Sun to Pluto, that would be around 9 billion miles, and we've gone around 200 so far. So it's time to get a move on and go to the first place where we could actually put our space boots down onto a solid surface, and that is, of course, the Moon. And NASA astronauts have visited the Moon. This is Buzz Aldrin on the Moon just over 40 years ago. And as soon as he and his colleague Neil Armstrong landed, they very quickly picked up rocks from the surface and put them into their pockets so that if they had to evacuate immediately, they would have samples of the Moon to take back with them. And when they came back, they brought Moon rock back with them so that scientists on Earth could try and work out what the Moon was made of. Now, very sadly, we went to the Moon and then we didn't go anywhere else. We went to the Moon and we just kind of stopped. And this is a shame because we could have got further by now. But there's no need to be too downhearted because there are many exciting new space missions planned. There is a private mission planned to the Moon called Excalibur Almaz. They're going to try and send human beings up to walk on the Moon. There's a whole space race based around getting to Mars. Who will get there first and how will they do it? But one thing I can tell you about these missions is that when they start happening, the kind of people in this room who are young now, you would be probably about the right age to go on one of these missions, which means that very possibly one of the younger people in this room could be the first person to walk on Mars. Now, for the rest of us who are perhaps never going to achieve quite such greatness, there are still options for flying in space. There's going to be a private space station launched as early as 2017, apparently, and it's going to be launched by a man who owns casinos in Las Vegas. Which raises the sort of interesting possibility that it'll be like a hotel. And so maybe you'll be able to go on holiday to the space hotel. And maybe if you do that, you would be able to send postcards to your friends that would look like this. Maybe you would go on a zero gravity holiday and be able to send back some pictures. That is me, and I'm not in space. I'm on a zero gravity flight. So I'm in an aeroplane which flies parabolically. So it flies up, up, up very steeply and then goes over a curve and sort of nosedives towards Earth. And this simulates zero gravity, which is just great fun. I don't know what else I can say about it. Now, we're talking about the book, George's Cosmic Treasure Hunt, and in that book, George also has to consider the possibility that we might not be alone in the universe. Their computer starts getting mysterious signals which come from an extraterrestrial source. And of course, you start thinking about, is there anybody out there, then this becomes a good question. What would they look like? Or rather, what would another life form sound like? We have radio telescopes that collect radiation, information, and noise, and scientists look at this data to try and see if they can pick out a regular signal, try and see if they can pick up a signal from someone else out there trying to contact us. And I've got a short clip now. This is from a program that my father made about contacting extraterrestrials.
The human race has only two options when it comes to looking for advanced aliens. We can listen, or we can be more active and broadcast our willingness to talk. We'd have to think very carefully about what we might say. I think this might be just a little too risky.
Reference to the fact that some... Oh, sorry about that. I've had some alien interference with my headset. That, of course, is a reference to the fact that some scientists on Earth think that we should not be making noise. We should not be trying to contact intelligent life forms because they might be so much more intelligent than us. And sometimes you have to say, would that really be so hard that we might not live to regret it? Now, George and the Big Bang. I think the title speaks for itself, but here's where we begin. We begin with our solar system. And we begin with a specific problem that George, our hero, is attempting to solve. He's asked Cosmos the computer to find a new home for his pig. But Cosmos, being a super intelligent computer, has somewhat misinterpreted the question. And he has drawn up a list of locations in the solar system where a pig might live. So we're now going to do a pig's tour of the solar system. And we start with this one. Here he is, it's very hot and it's very bright because he is very, very close to the sun. That was Fred on the planet Mercury, this scorched little ball of rock right next to the sun with terrifically high temperatures when you're in the sunlight, freezing cold when you're out of it. We can't really send, we wouldn't be able to send astronauts to Mercury. Wouldn't be a very nice place to go. But we can know from sending robotic missions that there is very probably no life on this planet. Now, this next planet, we take our pig to Venus. Now, Venus is often thought of as the Earth's twin. It's similar in terms of size and mass and composition. But if we were to go down to the surface, if we were to send our pig down to the surface of Venus, we would find a very different world. It's very hostile, it's very hot, smoggy clouds in the atmosphere, raining acid down on the surface. All the oceans evaporated long, long time ago. Venus is probably the least likely place in the solar system to harbor life. So I don't think our pig is going to want to stay very long on this one. Now, we've got a bouncing pig. and our pig has bounced off to Mars. Mars has lower gravity than the Earth, and so if we were on Mars and if you jumped up, you would be able to jump about 2.5 times higher than you can jump on Earth, and you would stay up for about 2.5 times longer. So if you were on the Martian plains, you would be able to sort of move in a great big long bouncing leap, covering a lot of ground very, very quickly. Mars has weather, not particularly nice weather, but it does have weather because it has an atmosphere. It has massive dust storms and volcanoes and all sorts of exciting things going on Mars, except for Martians, who just don't seem to be there. Now we've sent our pig further out. Our pig has gone to Saturn. And here he is. He's an orbital pig, because he is now orbiting the giant gas frozen ball of Saturn. And we saw Saturn's rings earlier when George and Annie did a fly past them on a comet. But here, we're going somewhere different. We're going to one of the moons of Saturn. Saturn has over 60 moons, and this is a very strange little frozen world called Titan. We're about 1 billion billion miles away from the sun now, so on the surface of Titan, it's getting a bit smoggy down there. Just recently, they found out that the atmosphere of Titan includes plastic, so maybe that's where our plastic in the ocean. I haven't worked out the link yet, but maybe there's something we can do. Lakes of methane, black lakes of methane, frozen surface. One of the reasons that scientists study Titan, though, is because they think Titan may be like the Earth was before life began. Now here we have a sinking pig. He's sinking down through the layers of gas on Jupiter, sinking down through the layers of gas on this amazing stripy planet towards the molten center. And there we are, upside down, Uranus, and windy pig on Neptune, which has the highest winds of the whole solar system. And of course, now we have a happy-looking animal because he's come back to Earth. And what this shows us is that Earth is just right for us. It provides us with the right atmosphere that we can breathe. It has sources of food. We have the sun. It provides us with exactly the right environment that we need to survive. And so why would we ever go into space? Why would we ever want to go anywhere else? We already have the perfect planet. So, what would be the reasons? Well, some people think that some scientists think that we need to spread out across space, that just living on one planet is cutting down our options for survival as the human race. And things that could happen were impact from space, great big chunk of rock hurtling towards the surface of the Earth, could break up the surface, release volcanic eruptions, tear the atmosphere into brown smoggy clouds of nitrogen, all sorts of really horrible things. Or we've got the things that we do to the planet ourselves. This pretty satellite image shows you an area that used to be entirely fertile ground. But now, the only vegetation is in that little red spot. And so we have a changing planet. We are impacting on our planet in all sorts of ways. And maybe, just maybe, we need to start thinking about where we're going to move to before we plunder all our resources. But where are we going to go? I mean, what can we do? One of the great discoveries of astronomy in the past 20 years has been that of extrasolar planets, planets in orbit around stars other than our sun. And so maybe we will find one of these planets, and it will be a second planet Earth, and we'll be able to travel these vast interstellar distances. We can't do that now. We've only really managed to go 200 miles to the space station and then onto the moon. But maybe one day this will become possible. So we've traveled a long, long way in space now. What about traveling through something else? What about traveling through time? Okay, this is difficult to explain, but I'll do my best. My father decided to have a time traveler's party. Right, you're with me, good. So he wrote all these invitations, and he left them in places that he thought would be likely to survive into the future, such as august university libraries. And he gave the very precise time and coordinates of his party. And his logic was that If time travel becomes possible in the future, then we should be being visited by tourists from the future, should be coming back to see us in the past. So his idea was, if he explicitly invited them, and then he was in exactly the place he said he would be, they might come on that day. Did everyone get that? Yeah, I have a very odd family. I don't know what else I can say to this. It's kind of embarrassing. So there we all were, and we actually were there. That's genuinely a location in Cambridge. It's called the Fellows Dining Room of Gonville and Caius. And we had balloons, and we had champagne, and we had crisps, and we sat there, and we sat there, and we sat there, and we're like, I think your guests are late, Dad. And eventually, we're like, well, can I have the crisps then? I don't think they're coming. And no, of course, nobody came. So yes, you could say that proves nothing, or you could say that my father doesn't throw very good parties, or that people don't respond. I don't know. There are lots of options there. But he absolutely insists that if time travel was possible, we would be visited now by tourists from the future. What about wormholes? Kip Thorne has suggested that wormholes are theoretically possible, except for the fact that you'd need a vast amount of a type of exotic matter, which as yet nobody has invented, which strikes me as a bit of a problem. But what else? What about looking back to the past? We can send telescopes into space, and they look back over great distances, and they sort of give us a snapshot of the past. This is the deep field of Hubble. And every dot that you see there is not a star, it's a galaxy. And some of those galaxies, you're seeing them as they were 10 billion years ago. So you're actually looking back in time. And the other thing we can do, we can build experiments which recreate the early universe, like the Large Hadron Collider. And this is what features in George and the Big Bang. There's a mysterious, sinister group who wish to destroy the Large Hadron Collider because, for reasons of their own, they do not wish the secrets of the early universe to become known. So, those are the George books. As I think most of you probably realize, I write these books primarily with my father, Stephen Hawking. And here he is in zero gravity himself, free, floating. It's a beautiful image. If you look at the smile on his face, he has been released. He is a theoretical physicist, which means he looks for ways to understand the universe around us using the laws of physics. And he has done this all his life, and he has attempted to explain his discoveries and the work of his colleagues to a general public. He wanted to be able to explain the work that he and his colleagues and his forebears have done in language that you and I could understand. And in writing the children's books, what we've tried to do is we've tried to take it a step further. We've tried to take it to a younger age group to show them that science is accessible. It is interesting. The great thrill of discovery. This is a nice picture of my father. I love this picture of my father. One thing I just want to tell you very quickly about him, as you can see, he's in a wheelchair. He's had a very long illness, which has taken away his ability to move his muscles. And part of that means that he has lost his speaking voice. And the rectangular black box that you see on the front of his chair, that is a computer that functions as a speech machine. And so he now speaks through a computer, and we're going to hear him talking again in a minute. And when you hear him, I want you to try and remember, although he sounds robotic, it is a real man who's using a computer to give himself back the voice that his illness has taken away. So I think that he has earned the last word.
Hello, this is Stephen Hawking. Thank you for joining me on the Cosmic Treasure Hunt today. It is an amazing journey, which takes us huge distances across the universe. But we don't just travel through space. Our journey also takes us through time, right back to the origins of the universe itself. We travel in search of knowledge. We want to know many things. We want to know if human beings can live on another planet. We want to know if there is anyone else out there. And we want to know how it all began. We are searching for an understanding of the laws of our universe. This is the greatest treasure of all. If we find it, we will be able to see from the Big Bang right into the distant future. Thank you for listening, and good luck on all your cosmic journeys. We...
So, thank you very much for listening, and good luck on all your cosmic journeys. And the reason my father says that is because it won't be him, and it won't be me, who travels farther across the universe than anyone has been before, or who maybe designs a robotic mission and sends it out to explore distant planets, or who perhaps picks up the first signal of alien life, or who maybe uses theoretical physics to travel in their mind across the whole universe. It will be one of the young people in this room today. So I'd like to say to you all, good luck on all your cosmic journeys, and thank you so much. I need to say thank you to the Perimeter Institute for hosting me. It's been an absolute honor to be invited to speak here today. I'd like to thank Greg and Tonya for making it so pleasant and for all the arrangements, all the hard work you put into making this talk happen. And I'd like to thank all the scientists who very kindly worked with me, who gave me information, who talked to me, who made their energy and their skill and their passion and their imagination available to you and to me. And most of all, I'd like to thank my father. All right.
Lucy will now take questions. So we've put a microphone right here, and it's well lit, so you can make your way down and just form a line, so I'll know how many questions we have coming. And youngsters in the audience, this is your opportunity to ask your imagination question to Lucy Hawking.
Or you can ask
author.
A science question, because we've also got Dr. Raymond Laflamme here from the Perimeter Institute on hand to answer any question in science you want to ask.
So while you're thinking of your question and making your way to the microphone, let me ask this question, Lucy. You have written a series of books. You've inspired young kids around the globe with them. When did you decide, and what inspired you to put pen to paper and start writing children's books?
My son had a birthday party, and my father came to the birthday party about halfway through, and it was as though a magician had arrived. My son's friends were so intrigued by him, and they were asking him questions. And one of the boys went up to my dad and said, "Oh, Stephen, what would happen if I fell in a black hole?" And my dad told him, he said, "Well, you know, if it's a big black hole, you won't notice much when you go over the event horizon. But if it's a smaller one, you'll be torn to spaghetti straight away." And I just thought, that's a story. That is a story. That's a great story. We need to write a story about a young boy who travels across the universe and who has all these adventures, including a black hole. And so that's where it all started.
Thank you. That's great. And here we have our first question.
Hello.
Hello. I am curious to know what you think is the greatest challenge in inspiring the young children and youth of the generation now to pursue science as a future occupation and to view it as an important area of research and focus.
Well, that is a very good question. I sort of feel that should be answered by the Perimeter Institute, who do a much better job of that. So I feel like passing that over to Greg, actually. What do you think, Greg?
That is a really nice passover. And could you just repeat the question? And I'll pay attention.
Basically, what I'm curious about is what you view as the biggest challenge in inspiring young people of today to pursue science as a future occupation and as an important source of research, area of research.
I think that the challenge is sharing the true mystery and joy of what science has to offer. So often, when we're young, our curiosity is natural. It bubbles up. We're looking and interested in asking questions about everything. As we get older, we turn into ourselves and try to be a little more academic. And in the process of trying to remember things for tests, we forget, you know what? Science is truly a creative endeavor. What we really try to do in all of the work that we do and our resources that we share is to show children that science is still a mystery. There's so much amazing information that we don't know, and it's a quest, and to go on that quest. And it's that curiosity-driven piece, I think, that once they know and once they realize it's still there, it's inspiring. So that's what we try to do.
Thank you. Oh, I think the microphone
excellent.
Just comes out of it. Hello.
Hi. My name is...
I did the same earlier. Yeah, I had exactly the same problem.
I'm curious when time travel will be possible.
That's a very, very good question. And if I could answer that, I would might not be here. I might be in my time machine. What do you think, Ray?
Lucy, you mentioned that you had this party, and you were wondering if our father was throwing good parties.
Yeah.
I've been to wonderful parties from your dad.
You mean you weren't invited?
So maybe I am one of these tourists coming from the future.
Maybe you are. Well, I think nobody knows. I think at the moment, do you mean time? I think I'm going to hand this over.
So we need to find a special type of matter to make these wormholes, for example, to be able to go back in the past. And we have not been able to do this yet. So in science, we can use our imagination to go somewhere or to try to make some discoveries, but we don't know when these things happen. And we cannot get the answer. But our imagination opens the door, and we don't know how long it takes to get somewhere.
Thank you. Thank you. Very good question. All right, let's go to another question. Go ahead.
How long might it actually take to build a moon city?
How long will it take to build a moon city? I think it would depend a lot on the transport systems as to how fast we can get materials up there. And if you could have rockets that could leave, come and go quite quickly, then you could probably build it quite quickly, I should think. I don't know, I should think you could get it up and running in a year, maybe. But perhaps I'm just very optimistic.
Thank you. Great question. Go ahead.
I have two questions. Mm. The first one, wouldn't, if you, like, you use something as a brace to stop the wormhole, wouldn't it have to be something like dark and earthy? But what happens if it were too strong? Would the wormhole just rip apart?
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Good job.
My second question is, will you make a fourth book?
I'm actually just finishing writing a fourth book at the moment, and in fact, one of my contributors is sitting in the audience who just answered your question. So in fact, Dr. Laflamme is one of my new contributors, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was wondering which book was your favorite?
I think my favorite book is actually George and the Big Bang, because it's the most complicated one to write, because it's an adventure story. So I'm trying to write an adventure story, and in an adventure story, there has to be some suspense, like what's going to happen. But I'm also trying to write about the origins of the universe, and we sort of know that's happened, because that happened 13.7 billion years ago. So it's a difficult topic to tell a story around. So I think that's why I like it, because it made me work the hardest.
Excellent. Go ahead.
In one of your books, George brings back the asteroid, it like turns into rubble. Would that actually happen?
What, if you brought back
If I went out into outer space, took a space rock, brought it home, would that like evaporate?
It doesn't evaporate, it sort of crumbles into dust.
Okay.
So yes, that probably would. We thought it was quite a soft, we theorized it was a very soft rock that crumbled and got lost, unfortunately. Because I'm sure a lot of scientists would have liked to get that, got their hands on it.
Okay, I have a science question, fairly complicated one.
Okay, he's your guy.
So black holes, they suck in light, but also they can sort of bend it. Am I right? They can bend light around it. They can, yes, without it actually trapping it. So that would theoretically slow down the light. So is it possible using black holes or a black hole as sort of time mirrors to look at something in two different points in time simultaneously?
What do you do next summer for a project? So I don't think we can use black holes as mirrors, but we can make the light goes around, and we see this in the sky. Sometimes we look at some galaxies, and instead of being little straight lines, when you look at the disk, you see them kind of warp in some direction. And we can also sometimes see an image of a galaxy that has gone with matter between you and that galaxy, and then has gone in two different ways. And we can see this. So it does bend lights in different ways. So in that sense, it's some kind of form of mirror or bending of the light makes you see things in different ways.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll let the experts handle the science questions. I had more of a personal one. As you were growing up, given your dad and everything, dinner conversations, were they more like the reality of the potential for an Einstein-Rosen bridge, or were they football matches and
no, it was more the first, your first option. It was quite an exotic way to grow up in that I grew up in Cambridge. We actually lived in a Cambridge college, in a Cambridge college apartment. My parents were not at all well off. My father was a fairly sort of obscure, very profoundly disabled theoretical physicist. And his life was basically physics and physicists, as you said, coming to dinner and having conversations, the extraordinary conversations around the dinner table. And it was just really odd. I mean, it's a really strange way to grow up, but obviously we thought it was normal. Because what else do you know when you're a kid? And I mean, to the extent where I didn't even really understand my father's condition until I was at school and I realized I drew a picture of my father and he was sitting down and everyone else drew their dad standing up. And I suddenly thought, where's my father sitting down? Everyone else's dad is standing up. Why is that? And so it's the same. It's that process of realizing, understand. But I did grow up in Cambridge and it's a very strange town. So I had a lot of really peculiar friends with really weird families too, so it was kind of okay.
Hello.
Hi.
My question's kind of simple. What do you think is the coolest thing about space?
Oh, that's such a great question. There are so many cool things about space, but I think the amazing thing about space is that we have the ability to go there in so many different ways. We can go there in a rocket, we can send a robot out, we can take photos of it with a space telescope, we can listen to it with radio telescopes, and very clever people like Dr. Laflamme and my father can think their minds all the way across the universe. So I think the best thing about space is that we, as human beings, have the ability to understand it.
Thank you. Okay, hi. Hi. So my question is, I've heard about scientists taking ideas from nature and applying them to human problems that we face today. Mm-hmm. So do you think it would be possible to take things that exist in space, like the way you were explaining how stars create the elements, would we be able to take stuff from space and apply that to human problems here on Earth?
Do you have any category of human problem that you're thinking of?
I've heard of scientists that had a problem where they had to have water blockages, mm-hmm. and they went to to the ocean and found these seashells that would stop the water blockages, mm-hmm. themselves, nature had figured out their own way.
That's very cool.
Say we're running, for example, we constantly talk about the way we're running out of gases and mm-hmm. how we need to find new ways of energy. So if we know that stars, when they explode, when they die, they create those elements, could we harness that ability and make gas so that we would never run out?
Well, I kind of feel that that's such a brilliant question. I'll say something and then I'm going to pass it over. We're doing a lot of one thing that's a lot of energy is going into now is to this attempt to do mining, is to bring back elements, bring back minerals from space, and even maybe from the moon or from asteroids, to try and capture resources in space and bring them back down to Earth. But that's not obviously not quite your question. There are all sorts of technologies that were developed in space that have a profound impact on our life on Earth, toothpaste tubes to MRI to all sorts of other technologies, which were like your cell phone camera is actually a sort of grandchild of technology developed for Hubble. So there are all those kind of things where technology leaps ahead in space. But actually, what do you think, Ray? What do you think the...
I think it's a great, another summer project. So this is good for recruitment coming here.
Yeah, you've all been signed up to the Perimeter Institute for next summer. We didn't tell you that when you came in because we didn't want to put you off. But
so when you were talking, I was thinking, very good idea. What would I do if I could extract something out of space? And the first idea I come is something called dark energy. So we look at the universe and we don't fully understand why it is expanding at the rate it is. And there's something missing that we have, which we call dark energy. Can we create that dark energy on Earth and be able to use it to solve our energy problems? That's one possibility.
One thought I've always liked, which I know is not possible, but I just like the idea, is that we could put a little black hole in orbit around the Earth and put all our garbage in it.
We have two more questions.
Would we actually want to time travel if we could? Because what if we got stuck really, really far back where we didn't have the kind of supplies to live that we had today? What if we went really far back and our time traveler broke? Then
I know. What if you went back and took a brick and the pyramids fell down? I mean, there's so many things. There's actually something called the grandfather paradox, which is about the fact that there's a sort of cosmic censorship that stops you going back into the past, because what if you went back to the past and you changed something, and so the present wasn't possible? So you went back to the past and you somehow managed to get rid of your own grandfather, meaning that you couldn't actually ever be born. So no, I think it's a lovely topic for imagination, to think, well, what would it be like for me as a 21st century person to go back to the 3rd century BC? And it's a sort of great imaginative topic, but I think it's probably one of those journeys that is better in your imagination than in reality.
And our last question of the evening.
What would be the closest black hole that we know of that in our galaxy?
Well, is it the one at the center of our galaxy?
That's it.
There's a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And I think most galaxies have as far as we know.
That's what we think.
Have a very large black hole at the center of them, but it's quite a long way away. I can't tell you how far it is. Do you know how far? I know how far it is across the galaxy, weirdly enough. It's 620 million billion miles, I think.
So about half.
Yeah, I meant about half. It's about halfway there.
It's a good thing it's far away.
Yeah.
Because it's a one-way journey down there.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, first let's thank collaborator.
Thank
Ray
you.
And Lucy Hawking.